Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Judith Stacy about the diversity of cultural approaches to marriage and why we should have maximum freedom. Also, Rick Santorum is running for president, but he probably can't get much beyond the extremist vote. And Rush Limbaugh's response to Anthony Weiner is getting unhinged. People can't stop talking about Slutwalk. Rebecca Traister was on NPR discussing the protests, the attention they've gotten, and some of the criticisms.
Well, I completely applaud the movement. I mean, listening to the interview with Heather and Anna, how can you not? Here are young women. And Jessica Valenti is a feminist activist who pointed this out in the Washington Post. This is one of the most active, vibrant, exciting forms of protest we've seen within a feminist movement in decades. These are grassroots organizers. These are not big organizations that are printing out signs. These are young women who obviously feel very strongly about the way that their sexuality is being policed and discussed. And feel very strongly about the victim blaming at the root of their project, and they are coming out in droves. And that is thrilling news for anyone who cares about gender equity and the feminist movement in the United States.
Seriously, the proof's in the pudding. People can ring and wring their hands, but the fact of the matter is that these protests are getting coverage and lots of it, and it's forcing people to talk about sexual violence and victim blaming. Well, Rick Santorum is officially running for president. With Newt Gingrich, Donald Trump, and Mike Huckabee out of the race, and Sarah Palin probably not in it, Santorum actually may do some damage in Iowa, at least to Mitt Romney's campaign, though I'm unclear if Tim Pawlenty will be able to retain all those Iowa primary voters who flocked to the candidate who best represents the Christian right. And the reason is that Santorum is just more hardcore with the anti-woman, anti-gay stuff. As I noted last week, anti-choicers are up in arms because Tim Pawlenty hesitated to say that doctors who perform abortions should be thrown in jail. Santorum is not restrained like that.
That would be taken to life, and I believe that that any doctor who performs an abortion, that I would advocate that any doctor that performs an abortion should be criminally charged for doing so. I've never supported criminalization of abortion for mothers, but I do for people who perform them.
Anti-choicers hide behind this "we won't send the mother to jail" nonsense because they think it shields them from the accusation of sexism. Of course, in reality, it's incredibly sexist. The base argument is that abortion is murder, but women who pay for this murder are too simple and stupid to know what they're doing and to be held accountable. Plus, it's a lie anyway. A woman in Idaho was just arrested and charged for self-abortion because she supposedly had passed the 20-week mark, and abortion is illegal after 20 weeks there. Indeed, self-abortion puts lie to the little anti-choice fairy tales about hapless women who are too stupid to know better being pushed into abortion by evil doctors in it for the money. That's why antis just try to pretend that self-abortion isn't an issue. But I'm going to just go ahead and say that all of Santorum's blather about fetal life is just a cover for the real reason that he opposes abortion. I would argue that Santorum opposes abortion because he's a right-winger who objects to women's liberation and sexual freedom. The reason I think this is because he objects to contraception as well.
But, you know, I'm not a believer in birth control, and it's for artificial birth control. Again, I think it goes down the line of being able to do whatever you want to do without having the responsibility that comes with that.
He claims in this clip to legally support it, but this is a slippery thing. In his book, he supported legal contraception for married women, but felt unmarried women should be on their own. This is not an anti-abortion for fetuses position, because when you want laws that will raise the number of unwanted pregnancies, even if you're limited to single women, the abortion rate will go up. So I'd say the connection between his anti-abortion and anti-contraception position is hostility to female sexuality. He's pretty blatant when he says that he simply objects to people doing what they want, which is harmful to society because apparently it means that people get to do what they want. Of course, if you're pro people being happy, like I am, then the whole people doing what they want if it doesn't harm others thing is a pretty good deal. Some call it by the word freedom, in fact. Santorum isn't just anti-woman, but he's also anti-gay. So much so that he's drawn the famous ire of sex advice columnist and gadfly Dan Savage.
He gave an interview to the AP where he said he compared gay relationships to man on dog, famously, and incest. And what a lot of straight people don't realize about that interview, of course it upset the homos, a lot of straight people don't realize about that interview was that he was arguing not just for the state's right to regulate the private sex lives, the private intimate contact of gay people, but of straight people. In that interview, where he argued that gay people shouldn't be able to get married or have sex without the police kicking down the door, he argued that the state, he also pointed out that it was going to be a tragedy if the Supreme Court overturned sodomy laws, because that would mean the state couldn't regulate masturbation.
So Dan decided to name some gross sexual thing after Santorum and ended up deciding on the frothy mixture of lube and fecal matter that is sometimes the product of anal sex. He then started a Google bombing campaign of people using that word Santorum and linking to the page that gave the definition. Now the number one hit when you Google Santorum is the word that Dan invented. To be clear, of course, it's not good if your bouts of anal sex generally feature Santorum. You really should try to be as clean as possible if you're having anal sex, because fecal matter is really very full of dangerous germs. But it does happen sometimes, and now there's a word for it. And Rick Santorum has to deal with it.
It is the worst dragging of a politician's name through the frothy mud since the sad case of Senator Cleveland D. Steamer. Unfortunately, folks, Rick Santorum complaining about the more popular Santorum only made things worse. Last week, Santorum was one of the hottest search terms on Google. The only people who haven't heard about this are the Amish. I have a feeling he'll do well with the Pennsylvania Dutch. They've had a similar name problem with their Dutch ovens.
And that's the thing. Even if Santorum somehow gets away from the fecal associations, he'll still be the guy who wants single women to be forced off their birth control and thinks that two adults of the same gender having sex is the same thing as bestiality. This is increasingly just not going to work for most voters. A recent CNN poll that came out, after all, showed that people who think that the government should promote traditional values has dropped to below 50% of the population, the first time since they started asking the question. Santorum is becoming a relic.
I'd like to welcome Judith Stacy to the program. Judith is a professor of social and cultural analysis and sociology at NYU. She's the author of numerous books and articles, and she's here today to talk about her latest book, Unhitched: Love, Marriage, and Family Values from West Hollywood to Western China. Welcome to RealityCast, Judith.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, well, let's start with your book is an epic story spanning the globe, and as you look at the family lives of gay men in West Hollywood, the lives of polygamous South Africans, and the marriage shunning Mosu, is that how you pronounce it?
I've been told they pronounce it Masaw. I mean, that's the way it sounded to me when I was there.
Oh, Masaw, people of Masaw.
Like that, yeah, Masaw.
The Masaw.
Right.
People of Southwest China. So why did you investigate these three communities?
Right. Well, this is not a comprehensive survey of family diversity around the globe today, but it's three very different points and types of families that I think helped me learn a lot of things and make a number of points that I think are very useful to political issues in the U.S. involving family change and family diversity. I started out with the, which I did do a very in-depth study of different forms of gay men forming different forms of intimacy and choosing whether to become parents or not in the greater Los Angeles area. So not just West Hollywood, but that sort of signifies to many people, you know, kind of the gay part of L.A. I was interested in gay men not just because they're interesting, but because I think the family decisions and the kinds of families that they're forming help us learn a lot about the kinds of issues that almost everyone has to face today in dealing with family life. And then I went to South Africa because, in part because of the refrain in the U.S. that the response to the struggle for same-sex marriage has often been that, well, if you legalize same-sex marriage, it paves a slippery slope to having to legalize polygamy. And I thought, well, everyone, you know, just either poo-poos that or believes it, but doesn't take it seriously. And in fact, there's one country in the world, and that is South Africa, that has both legal same-sex marriage and legal polygamy, so that it would be really important to look at what that looks like on the ground and what some of the political issues were in the history there. So that's what led me to the study in South Africa. And then the Mosa were, it's a culture I'd long known about that really challenges almost everything that most Westerners believe about family life and marriage, that marriage is universal, and also it speaks very directly to the question of, you know, whether children need both a mother and a father, and whether in fact the mother and father family is best. And those were arguments that were coming up constantly in the debates around changing family forms in the U.S. So I went to investigate this family system that for 2,000 years has not been based on marriage or on sexual union at all. It's based on a maternal extended family, and it completely separates out the realm of family life from the realm of romance, sex, and love, which is a nighttime activity.
So I think my listeners are pretty familiar, I think, with the mores of sort of gay families in the United States. But what did you find about polygamy in South Africa and these non-marriage community in China?
Well, I think your listeners probably imagine that they're very familiar with gay types of family life in the U.S., though I think I found a number of things and make a couple of points that are maybe a little less familiar or that need more discussion. But I'll answer first about polygamy and the Mosa of southwestern China. I was interested in the way in which South Africa was trying to accommodate and navigate between, on the one hand, respect for different cultural traditions, and on the other hand, trying to honor contemporary ideals of social justice for gender and sexuality. So their constitution is the first constitution in the world that bans discrimination on grounds of many, many things, but gender, sexual orientation, and even marital status, and that makes it pretty unique. And it is also the only nation in the world in which both same-sex marriage and polygamy are legal. Among the surprising things I learned when I got there was that polygamy in South Africa is only legal for black South Africans if they were part of one of the traditional cultures that practiced polygamy, because it's under the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act that polygamy is legal. So they don't grant legal polygamy for non-blacks, not even for their Indian Muslim significant minority community. So that was really interesting. And then I actually studied did interviews with some white people suing for the right to have plural marriage on grounds of racial discrimination, that it wasn't fair, and that that their traditional culture, i.e. the Old Testament, had polygamy, and so they should be allowed to practice that too. That was pretty surprising. But I also did interviews out in KwaZulu-Natal in a very poor agricultural part of the former homelands of the Zulu, which does have practiced polygamy. And I learned a lot of interesting things about the ways in which, while this might not always be a first choice for many women, for many it was the lesser of evils, and in some cases it could even be a first choice that could make some sense under their conditions. And that led me back to look at the history of the suppression of Mormon polygamy in the 19th century in the United States, and to arrive at some surprising understandings and ideas about that.
Well, and I'm guessing with that, the advertisement for your book says that this is undermining a lot of conservative arguments, but also it kind of goes against certain feminist prejudices, and I'm assuming that's what you're talking about there. Could you explain?
Yes, I can. I mean, I don't advocate polygamy, but I do argue for decriminalizing polygamy, and I discuss in great detail some of the hypocrisy and bad faith in a lot of U.S. attitudes towards, you know, how a very common family value is to presume that everyone wants monogamy, and that clearly is not the case. And I talk a lot about what I call the Scarlet Letter men, the Schwarzeneggers and the John Edwards and many of these, all of these people who espouse one thing and practice another, but who in those two cases actually are involved in what I call a kind of clandestine form of polygamy. And as some of our legal theorists have shown that, I've come to believe that criminalizing polygamy is actually worse for women and children than decriminalizing it, and that it has turned, it allows the kind of autocratic and ruthless patriarchs like Warren Jeffs, the leader of the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, who's and the leader of the YFC Ranch, it allows them to sort of kick out the boys, to accumulate all the women and girls for themselves, engage in underage sex, all kinds of things. And that if it were not a felony, and if we didn't have this whole history of the, sort of leaving it to the underground, then it would be easier to protect women against coerced forms of polygamy and to allow that to be an issue of greater consent. So that's certainly an unexpected conclusion I came to. I also think that feminists have to give up on insisting that all women want the same kinds of intimate equality that feminists do. I think our goal should be to try to create the conditions that make that possible, but it is not our position to judge if that's not what some women want. And I certainly did learn that that was not what some women want. We may feel like that's what they should want, but we should try to persuade them rather than, trying to make illegal something that they might actually want.
So I guess we have time for one more question, but I want to get back to the gay men in California that you interviewed. How were your findings kind of different than what you think the average listener or reader would initially assume about their lives?
Well, one thing is that I show what a huge diversity of intimacy there is, and also how the generation before the big push for same-sex marriage was probably more creative and expansive in its family forms than it is now becoming. So I basically argue that legalizing same-sex marriage, while it's obviously necessary on civil liberties grounds, probably will not increase social equality. It'll probably do the opposite, and that and the other problem is it'll encourage more hypocrisy. So I argue for redefining fidelity to mean integrity rather than a one-size-fits-all model of sexual ethics. And I show, a trio that lived together under their particular set of rules, couples that have worked out very ethical non-monogamy arrangements. But more important, I think, from the point of view of public policy, I talk about families that are co-parenting with three or four parents and how the push to same-sex marriage actually goes against that. And so I want to argue for forms of recognition of different kinds of family coalitions that is the opposite of putting everything on the idea of just the sexual couple, whether it's a heterosexual couple or a same-sex romantic couple.
And how do you think the government could do that?
Well, I've talked to a lot of, legal theorists and all, and there are various ways. I mean, Nancy Polakoff's work, who is a feminist lesbian law professor at American University and wrote Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, has been thinking about that a lot. There are a number of possibilities under either contract law or under family law. I would base it on the parent-child unit, whether it's 1, 2, 3, 4, so that I would allow, and I'd probably put a limit of 4 just because I think you have to have some templates and limits, and then you can arrange for exceptions. But I think that we should be encouraging people who want to share resources and make commitments to rearing children together to do that instead of insisting that there's only one way. So I think we should take, I would get rid of benefits and privileges for married couples entirely and give benefits and privileges and responsibilities to citizens in general. But in particular, I would encourage child-rearing family definitions and forms of support. So that would be the way I would go. And that's kind of, it fits with, though I think it's a bit more expansive than the way feminist legal theorist Martha Feynman has proposed ways of dealing with caretaking and breaking the hold of what she once called the sexual family.
Wow, it sounds really fascinating. I highly recommend checking out this book. My guest today has been Judith Stacy. Her book is called Unhitched. It's Love, Marriage, and Family Values from West Hollywood to Western China. And it's out on NYU Press and is available online and at local bookstores. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Judith.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me. And I did hear that it's just gone up on Amazon on an e-reader for Kindle as well. So that's good news.
Oh, that's great.
Rush Limbaugh is usually just an impossibly sexist pig, but lately things on his show have gotten especially bad. It's the Anthony Weiner thing. It's clear that Limbaugh doesn't have it in his heart to feign outrage that a man cheated on his wife or even, as some people allege, was harassing women. So finally he happened upon a novel solution, which is to blame women for believing we have rights. He paints a kind of amazing picture of how he believes that Democratic men are, for lack of a better word, pussy-whipped bozos whose wives browbeat them in the name of feminism. It's truly amazing.
Why can't we blame liberal women for what these politicians are doing? They have feminized politics to such a degree that men can't be men anymore. They all got to be out there and try to prove that they're Alan Alda or whoever is the definition of a real man. Michael Kinsley, I don't know. But look at what we're told. We're told that Weiner is the man of the hour. What he is a genuine pencil neck geek who is sexting. He's not even got a voice on the other end of the line. My God, Hugh Hefner at least showed the real thing. Put the pajamas on, head the babes over to the mansion.
He claims that Weiner's reputation as a womanizer and a playboy is stupid because he insinuates that it was based on those photos and chats. In reality, Weiner had this reputation before all this came out because of his interactions with actual women, which I don't think would have been much of an issue generally, but since he's been married, that changes the situation. Limbaugh glazes over that, which I guess makes sense as Limbaugh's been married 4 times. I can see that he has trouble remembering that marriage is different than being single. But Limbaugh was so infatuated with the idea that liberal men are a bunch of cringing, emasculated children who let feminists push them around, and he ignored that and just kept rolling.
Weiner texting, sexting, whatever, is no different than Obama heading out to the fast food joint when it comes to food. The difference is at home, Obama has to eat whatever Michelle puts in front of him, which is rot gut. So when he leaves home, he overdoses on food that he's not allowed. What did Weiner do? Now, I'm making excuses for it. Do not misunderstand me here. But these feminists, liberal women, have feminized politics to such a degree that politicians, male politicians, can't even be men, which may explain why politicians as a group are often caught in these sex scandals.
The levels of delusion here are extraordinary, truly. Let's start with this image of Obama being served dinner by his wife, who is supposedly watching him and nagging him about his diet. Sounds like projection to me. Obama is the president. His wife doesn't cook for him. They have a White House chef. I imagine his life is nothing like this rant. This is about Limbaugh assuming his listeners are overgrown men children who kick and scream and cry that they want a steak when their wives dare put vegetables in front of them. I'll also note that Limbaugh claims he's not making excuses for Wiener, but it seems that he's defining being a man in such a way that pretty much requires screwing around. So how on earth is that not making excuses? Is he trying to say if your wife doesn't want you to screw around, that's what causes screwing around? And that the way women don't get screwed around on is to roll over when their husbands screw around? I'm really confused here. Actually, I'm not. Limbaugh doesn't give a flip if he makes sense. He's just flailing around trying to blame feminists for things men choose to do. By the way, women cheat too. I guess Limbaugh would blame feminism for that as well. Limbaugh really loved this notion that it's women to blame for what he considered a scourge of liberal men cheating, and so he doubled down during another part of the show.
You know, here's the thing. I wonder, why is it that Anthony Weiner turns out to be the kind of guy he is? How does that happen? If we're going to bring this stuff up, folks, let's talk about it. Let's bring it up. Who, what kind of women has Anthony Weiner been around his whole life? He has been around a bunch of these kinds of women who have been attacking testosterone, who have been attacking traditional male roles. He's been around women to whom the idea of a real guy is some metrosexual.
He continued to rant like this for a while, basically painting Anthony Weiner as an emasculated victim who had to cheat in order to regain his manhood after being subject to a bunch of feminist harpies. Now, what's funny about this is there's like 5 conservative sex scandals for every liberal one. For every Anthony Weiner, there's a Larry Craig, David Vitter, Ted Haggard, Mark Sanford, and Newt Gingrich. Those men aren't surrounded by feminists, so what's their excuse? In fact, as much as Limbaugh would love to blame feminists for everything, this is just the stupidest reasoning roughly in forever. It's been demonstrated by sociologists time and again that people who embrace feminist values tend to divorce less and have happier marriages. The reason egalitarian marriages tend to be happier is really complicated, but part of it is that liberals actually value sex as a positive thing and are therefore more likely to address sexual needs in an open and honest manner. Obviously, that doesn't mean that cheating is completely eliminated, but it's definitely less common. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. More Rush Limbaugh edition. Sorry, I don't mean to overwhelm you, but Mike Stark called into Limbaugh's show when Limbaugh was ranting about Anthony Weiner, and he asked Limbaugh about being stopped with Viagra while traveling to a nation that is known for its prostitution industry.
So you're repeating internet rumors based in hatred and misinformation and typical brainlessness on the left. None of that which you described took place whatsoever. But you know what? Even if it had, it doesn't change what Weiner did. And it doesn't change the way Weiner has handled it. And it doesn't change what Bill Clinton did. And it doesn't change Bill Clinton lying under oath. It doesn't change any of the reprobate activities that the Democrats and leaders of that party have engaged in. It doesn't change a thing.
Except that it actually did happen. He was caught traveling to the Dominican Republic with a bottle of Viagra, and it wasn't even in his name. Many of the women in prostitution in that country are underage, or they're under duress, or even non-consenting. But you know, as Rush says later in his rant, making sure that a Democrat is humiliated by penis pictures is a necessary part of saving the Republic.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.